The theme for this retreat is a practice concept that's very powerful for Theravadan Buddhists. In some ways it holds the center of their kind of religious confidence, inspiration, value, purpose. And it's the practice of refuge, sarana. And there is an external refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And there's an internal refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha within us. And the meeting of those two, when we really feel like one resonates with the other, what's inside of us, what we discover in ourselves, resonates with something that's outside, it can give birth to tremendous heartfeltness, kind of inspiration of the heart, gladness of the heart, a kind of delight. And that's why, one of the reasons why the three refuges are sometimes called the three jewels, because the word jewels is ratana, and the word delight is rati. So the three things that bring delight, three jewels. And the word refuge is, the synonyms or close synonyms of it that are often used in the tradition is lena, which means a cave, and another word which means shelter. So it's a refuge, a cave for safety. It's a place to go where we're safe. And it's said that the refuges, when a person really understands the refuges for themselves, it destroys all fear. And that's a powerful thing, to find some kind of safety from fear, live without fear. It also gives people tremendous confidence to be in the world. So the refuges are not meant to be withdrawal from the world. Somehow there's some kind of place to go hide and be safe, but rather the safety is found in the midst of the world, because we find it in our own hearts. We find the shelter within ourselves, and that's portable, that we carry with us anywhere we go. And many people begin with the external shelter, external refuge, and rely on it quite a bit to have confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and the values of them. But the goal is to discover it internally for oneself, find oneself something, some experience, some way of being, some sense of purpose, some practice that can come alive for us and provide us with not only a sense of safety in the world, fearlessness as we go through the world, but also, because of that, a tremendous confidence, so that we can engage in the world as it's appropriate to do. Last week, when I was thinking about these refuges, I had a very powerful reminder of a particular discourse that the Buddha gave. Discourse he gave to a king, Pisanadi, who was but kings of the time, they were the closest. They were kind of like almost like friends, same age. They knew each other for decades. And it's possible this king was a little bit pampered, because at some point, one of the suttas describes the Buddha giving him advice on diet, so he could lose some weight. So maybe he, you know, he was kind of, he was also known for being a little bit foolish. So he came to the Buddha once, and he said to the Buddha, so the Buddha asked him, how are you? And he said, oh, I'm busy. I'm busy conquering the neighboring countries and indulging in sensual delights. It's quite a nice statement. I'm busy, very busy, worrying and sensuality. So in the context of that, Then the Buddha gave him a little teaching, and he said something like, imagine that one of your messengers comes from the east and reports that the great mountain range, high as the clouds or higher or whatever, great, great mountain range is rolling towards you from the east, crushing everything in its way. And another messenger comes from the south and tells you, there's a great mountain range coming, rolling towards you, crushing everything in its path. Another messenger comes from the west and from the north, all with the same message. Mountains coming from all directions, rolling forward. There's no escape. I guess he's going to be crushed too. And so the Buddha says to him, what would you do? What would you do? Pisanati says, in that case, I would live the Dharma. Finally. but time. But this idea that, and then the Buddha goes on to say that aging and death is rolling towards us, crushing everything in its path. It's inevitable that it'll come. And so maybe it was kind of offering a wake-up call to this king, offering him some other perspective on life than the perspective of warring and sensuality. But this reminder that, you know, it's of aging and death, the existential kind of challenge that we all, sooner or later, one way or other, are going to face. What do we do? And the king says, well, live the Dharma. There's something in the Dharma. Even in the last minutes of our lives, the Dharma is available to provide safety, to provide purpose, to provide freedom. Even then. So in thinking about this story, I was thinking about the walls that come, the mountains that come rolling close, those walls, and being in walls, coming in and pressing in on us. And the first thing I thought about was a friend of mine who died this year, and she had cancer for many number of years, and was working with it as best she could. And then at some point, it had gotten worse. And I talked to her on the phone sometime in maybe September. And she said, and you know, it was clear that she was going to die. Dying was happening. That was what was next for her. And I would say that probably it was a conversation with her was among the top five happiest conversations I've ever had in my life. She was very, very happy. And in the course of that conversation, that happy conversation on the phone, she told me that she had set it up that the next day she would go to hospice. And it felt very genuine, very inspiring to talk to her. That was her response to the whole situation she was in. And so then about 10 days later or so, I went to see her in hospice. And she was in a small hospice in the Castro in San Francisco, and went into her little hospice room. And one of the first things that struck me about being in her room was how small the room was. It was smaller than the rooms we have here, the rooms you're living in here. And so it was kind of a few of us were in there, little chairs around her bed, and I kind of looked around, and she was kind of in and out of being, not consciousness exactly, but in and out of being in conversation with us and kind of drifting off in some place. And we had a nice visit, but I looked around, and felt very poignant that this woman's life, 70-some years, was coming, that was the last room she was ever going to enter in her life. And the walls, you know, had come in, literally, were close, small walls, and there she was, laying there. And I came to see her some days later, and it turned out to be just hours before she died. And then she was not quite as conscious as she had been before. Couldn't really have a conversation with her, but she knew I was here. And but she was a little bit agitated. And the thing I did with her was I chanted the refuges. And she got calm. She calmed down. And we'd be quiet for a while. At some point she'd get agitated. I'd chant the refuges. And even though I couldn't quite tell, it wasn't obvious that she could hear me in an ordinary conversational way. The refuges made a difference to her. She kind of knew them there, knew what was happening. And they had value for her. They connected her to something, inspired her. And then later, when she died, her daughter, who was there, thanked me so much and said she said it made a big difference, that chanting, that being with her. So that was her walls that came in. And I thought about the people who died in Oakland Fire. They also had walls that kept them in. The mountains of fire, I guess, rolled in. It probably was not a happy death at all, tragic death. And I thought of visiting the St. Anthony's Kitchen in San Francisco this last year. And there also was kind of felt very bounded. It was a large dining area, but the ceiling was kind of low and very kind of, the walls was very clear, and serves over 2,000 people for lunch every day. And the Tenderloin in San Francisco, very poor people. And the first wave, the first hour, are the elderly who live there, and they came in with all kinds of conditions, and many of them don't speak much English, and it was kind of poignant to kind of be there, and in their kind of smaller world they lived in, both in the kitchen, in the dining area there, but also in the Tenderloin and their world. And I had a sense, I didn't know them, didn't talk to much of them, but I had a clear sense as I was serving the meals that most of those people didn't know about the election, didn't know what was going on very far away. They were just trying to cope and survive, and they came with extra containers to, because they can get as much food as they wanted, and they get extra containers, fill it up, so to have for dinner or next day or something. And they kind of, the preciousness of life and being there, and this, you know, what is this life of ours, and what's important, and how do we serve, and how do we connect, and I know, as I was thinking about these mountains that are coming in for us, I was thinking about being in that dining room with those 2,000 people, this sea of humanity coming through. And then I thought about going to San Quentin, and there was also a place of walls this year, big walls, you know, you go in through solid walls. It's built kind of like a medieval castle, or with dungeons. It's quite an impressive place. And every year I go to see this program where they're teaching the inmates about principles of mindfulness, in a year-long program. It's a very powerful program called Guiding Rage into Power. They are in the weekly, every week they meet for a few hours, and they go through this intense group process, about 28, 30 men. In this year-long program, mindfulness and self-reflection and honesty and looking at their crime, looking at their background, looking at their pain, looking at how they're hurt, all kinds of things. And so we go into this room, and it's a modular building, you know, like trailers put together with a big room, you know, it's low ceiling and very different from the stone dungeons of everywhere else of San Quentin. And it's a kind of a sacred place, because not because of the ticky-tack module kind of building, but what goes on inside. And it's a safe place in San Quentin to people who come there. And one of the things that's but safe about them is that the different races in San Quentin can become friends in this space and this program. And they become very close to each other. But once they leave the room and go out into San Quentin out in the yard, they can't really show their friendship to each other. They have to kind of, because it's dangerous to be, integrate and connect with across the racial lines in San Quentin. But it's quite something to see them all come together and do this intense work, powerful work, of somehow turning their lives around. And of this 28 men that we usually in this program I see, most of them have murdered someone, and they're there for life. And it's and these are people who you can feel palpably. It's powerful to go into this room, and this idea of being kind of like the walls are in. We're in together. We're close. We're kind of our humanity is there together. And feel tremendous trust in these men because of the transformation and how they've changed and the wisdom that comes out of them. They can feel that how they've changed. So much so that, you know, I brought my 18-year-old son with me to see it, to be there. And to have him go through, I felt it was one of the best things I could have done as a parent was take my son to San Quentin. And to experience these men, and their wisdom and their transformation, and see what's possible, I thought it was quite remarkable. So, those by association of thinking about refuge and the story of the king and the mountains coming in, the walls coming in on us, and do these walls of our life that we live under that come in bearing that down on us inevitably, maybe the invisible walls, are they, are they there to oppress us? Are they there to frighten us? Or is there some way of living in the midst of it, free of them, finding freedom, or finding liberation, or finding love, finding compassion, finding a sense of purpose and value in our lives and meeting it? Can we become free? So the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha, the refuge, points to all of that and points to that possibility of freedom. And the core, so this refuge, there's three meanings of the word gacchami. Gacchami literally means to walk, and I like it that it means walk because rather than just to go because go is kind of vague, but walk is something you do with all your being, all of who you are. Because you walk into, you bring your everything along when you walk, and so to walk to refuge, to walk with refuge, is kind of more powerful. But the word gacchami in the Pali language has three meanings. It also means to understand. So it just doesn't mean that we just go for refuge, but we understand the refuges. There's some deeper understanding that comes into place. And finding this understanding, discovering this, the inner refuge, how it resonates, something inside of ourselves resonates what these triple refuges mean, is part of the task. The other meaning is, the other aspect of it is it involves an intention, a motivation. So it's not a passive thing to go for refuge and take refuge, but rather we can, we go for refuge so that it's a choice. That we that this is what I'm committing myself to do, this is what I want to do, this is where I want my life to be oriented around. It kind of gives guidance, it gives direction to one's life. In the chaos of life, this gives meaning, this gives a certain kind of order. I know what I'm about, I know what I'm doing. I'm living the values of these teachings, values of the Dharma. So there's three aspects of gacchami. So there's understanding, there's intention, and then there's the sense of confidence, a heartfeltness or devotion that goes along with it. And so the sense that this is something, it's an emotional thing. And we probably can't be transformed very much unless our emotions are somehow engaged. This is not just an intellectual exercise. that of understanding something, but what does it touch something? Is it, we place it in our hearts? Do we kind of find the seat in our hearts where it all kind of unfolds and grows? The word for faith in Buddhism, sadha, the etymology of it that some people offer is the seat of the heart, or the place on the heart. So understanding, intention, and the heartfeltness that goes along with this idea of refuge. So it can be said that probably the most important of the three refuges is the Dharma. And the Dharma kind of is a bridge between the Buddha and the Sangha. And the Dharma has generally said to have three meanings, the three aspects of it. In relationship to refuge, Dharma means the teachings of liberation, the practices of liberation, and the realization of liberation. And so we have this huge body of teachings, and I find the Buddha Dharma, the teachings of Buddhism, the more I study them, the more I'm in awe of them. It's a pretty amazing pointers or mirrors to our own freedom. And so it's been a great joy for me in my life to kind of encounter the teachings and read and be inspired by them and guided by them. I feel so lucky to have discovered them and to have them and go along with them. But the teachings aren't meant to be just remain out there as teachings and as intellectual exercises, but they're pointing to practices that we can do. And there's a wide range of practices that we can pick and choose from, depending on what maybe suits us in our particular disposition and what our needs are and our situation is. Sometimes, you know, mindfulness is said to be never wasted, so you can always do mindfulness practice. But there's practices of loving kindness, of compassion. There's practices of concentration, practices of ethics and service, and all kinds of things that are useful to do. When it's a refuge, is all have to do with liberation. And liberation is kind of a grand word that it's easy to bandy about, to kind of talk about and as if it's an all good thing. But I understand it to be a relatively simple concept. And that is to free the mind, free the heart from all the forces that bring it suffering or distress or fear or stress, that somehow the contraction, inner contraction gets released. The holding, the attachments, the clinging, the grasping, the resistance are released. And the third aspect of Dharma, the realization of liberation, involves that. This movement where we step and we let go, release, the ways in which we're contracted and held. And it's not a very particularly metaphysical or supernatural principle that what we're looking for, that ultimately is this kind of movement of the heart, movement of psychology, of freeing ourselves from the inner ways in which we're caught, inner ways in which we're contracted or tight or closed or afraid or angry or hostile or all these forces that go on. And so the third part of Dharma is the realization of liberation, is realizing in small and big ways this movement of freedom from how we've been limited, how we've been closed down, how we've been suffering, and to really have a visceral, personal taste and experience. Oh, look, there's space now, there's freedom now. And that can be in very small ways. There can be something that it could be really kind of almost so mundane you don't want to think of it as spiritual, right? It could be something like how you drive your car. And you finally, you know, decide you don't have to always drive as if you're in a hurry. or answering your phone. You don't have to rush and get the phone at the first ring. You can just kind of be at ease. Phone rings, you go get it. It seems ridiculous, right, to talk about that in the grand scheme of a world religion, how you answer the phone. But it's, you can experience some freedom right there and be inspired by it. Oh, yes, even there. Here at IRC, how you stand in line for the meal. There's freedom to be found there. And there's misery. And what do you find there? What do you how do you bring your attention to yourself, to mindfulness? How do you look at that? And then there's, as we do the practices, there are bigger, more expansive, more deeper kind of experiences of liberation that's possible. There's possible to be liberated from self, self-centeredness, conceit, self-preoccupation, self-fear. There's a whole kind of complex of selfing or self-making or self-defining activity that we do that can be very limiting, very painful, keep people in prisons with walls really close in. And to have the experience of this self-identity or self-preoccupation or conceit or self-contraction that we can so kind of get tight around, have that tightness loosened and then maybe just let go of, unravel, and feel the strength of that, the confidence, the power of that, the joy of that, is a really fantastic thing. Wow. So whether it's a small release, small liberation, or a large one, it gives us a taste of the freedom of a Buddha. And that's what gives us the sense of the inner refuge. But that's what it's about. It's here in myself. And the practice is here in myself. And the teachings are not really in a book. The book are just kind of a pale mirror for the teachings that reside inside of yourself. Because sooner or later, the idea is to become your own teacher and be able to recognize and find the teachings here for yourself. The Dharma is in you. And this is why in the Theravadan tradition, there's four refuges. And the fourth refuge is self. Have yourself as your own refuge. No other refuge, the Buddha said. Because it's your choice, it's your engagement, it's your discovery, it's your release that's at the heart of this practice. And so it would take, and you're valuable, you're important. And even though we're letting go of self-identity, or the kind of contraction around self-identity, we're letting go of conceit, we're letting go of me, myself, and mine in a certain kind of way, it's not a dismissal of yourself. It's not pretending you don't count, you're not important. It's the opposite, actually. You're so important. You're so valuable as a person that you're so important that if you only knew how important you were, you wouldn't be self-preoccupied. Then you wouldn't be so caught up in yourself. Because you're caught up in yourself and it just limits who you are rather than enhances you. Giving up self is how you become enhanced. So this inner refuge, we see it in ourselves, refuge in self, then gives us a reference point where something inside here resonates with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And that's when we have a sense of start having some glimmer of this inner refuge. Then we understand that when we take refuge in the Buddha, we're not taking refuge in the external Buddha, the person, though it's quite inspiring, whoever that person was. What this person discovered and what came from this person, I think is phenomenal. And as the more I'm in this kind of practice, the more I'm kind of in awe of what this person was about. But the real refuge that tradition talks about is the Buddha's awakening. And we only have a sense of what that awakening is when we have some experience of freedom ourselves. That's a reference point. I know a little bit now, like that. I have a small sense of it. I've done it in small ways. But I can, active imagination, I can imagine what it would be like if it was thorough. If it was all-encompassing. And I don't know if the Buddha did it completely, 100%. That's the idea. But he represents that capacity, that we can do it completely. And to live a life that we're going, that's the direction that our life has, is to keep clearing the cobwebs, clearing it all out, becoming freer and freer. Even if we don't get as free as possible, just to be on the path of freedom is one of the great tasks of life. It's a very satisfying life. It's a very purposeful life, just to be on the path. So we take refuge in the Buddha, and meaning we take refuge in the Buddha's awakening. We find safety in awakening. We find safety in the heart that has the capacity for freedom. We know that's where the real safety is resides, in the heart itself. The mountains are coming of age, aging, and death, and all kinds of mountains are coming, crushing everything in its way. But the heart doesn't have to be crushed. The heart can remain open and free. Like my friend who died, you know, was so happy that day she was checking herself into hospice. She'd done years of practice, so I felt very genuine that somehow her years of practice came to a head, or came to kind of showed its power and force at that point in her life. And I've had that experience with other practitioners who face death, how happy they've become. Another man who came to talk to me this year came and said, I've been diagnosed with cancer and doesn't look like there's much hope. And for about 2 months I was struggling, but now I'm happier than I've ever been. It's quite something. What does it take to discover something? What can be discovered that gives us that sense of possibility when the mountains are coming? And then the other side of Dharma is Sangha. And I can say with great confidence that I could not have practiced as much as I have done without community of other practitioners. And I've been supported, encouraged, challenged, appropriately, I think I have to say appropriately, irritated, helpfully irritated, by, you know, or challenged by the community in ways that I'm so glad for, because that was the material that helped me continue, supported me, challenged me, forced me to look at myself, open up in ways in myself, that I just, even to this day, I still feel very supported by being among other practitioners in the community. And coming here on retreat with all of you, I feel the support of all of you. I'm still practicing. And I feel like I come to these retreats to do my practice, and I feel very supported. You know, I feel it would be very different. I like practicing alone, but it's invaluable to practice with a group of people. And then, it's again speaking very personally, that all along, to know my teachers, to know people who have practiced thoroughly and deeply, and have that resonate with me and say, oh, yes, that's possible, and that's good. It's kind of like getting fed and nourished and guided and by something, you know, something, at some point, something begins to, maybe it's the mirror neurons or something, something begins to kind of resonate, vibrate, or you know, empathize, you know, it shows a way, or encouraging to meet other people who are free, and some degree of freedom. And that's also really invaluable to have models of that, not just people who practice, but people who show the fruits of it. You know, these two people I mentioned this year, that for this year I had talked to, who had cancer and who were dying, it was quite inspiring for me to feel their happiness as opposed to their distress. Just, wow, this is something. So, and part of the reason for, I think, at least for me, but I think part of the reason for the tradition why refuge is so important, the idea of refuge, is that we need support, we need inspiration, we need something that awakens the heart, that gives us a sense of kind of inspiration or delight, or points away. And we don't have to only rely on our own efforts. There is something bigger that's holding us here. We're held by our capacity for awakening. And as that capacity starts to kind of wake up, it supports us. And it's that capacity, even though it's kind of in us, it's not the self. It's not the usual place of agency and self and responsibility and blame and all that. It's a different whole different aspect of our being that becomes alive. And often when we struggle, excuse me, often when we struggle, it has a lot to do with one way or the other, with that smaller part of who we are, this idea of self and self-concept and self-identity and me, myself, and mine. And so the idea of going for refuge is to be reminded that there's a bigger container, the word that Andrea used, bigger context that holds us, that guides us, that's working through us, that's, you know, it's not just our efforts. And so, as an act of faith, the refuges are a reminder that we can kind of relax. We offer our practice, but we also kind of make space and allow for something that's deeper than anything we can imagine, anything we can orchestrate. Allow something to emerge, allow something to move through us, to allow something bigger than ourselves. Just like when we take refuge in the Sangha, we take a refuge in support of our interpersonal lives, our community lives. We know, you know, that children need to have strong family community connections to grow up in a very healthy way, and if they don't, things go a little bit difficult. We're very interpersonal beings, and the ways in which we touch each other and are connected are quite profound. And so how we're being held, or how we're being influenced, or how we're being supported in invisible ways by being in community, also means we can relax and trust in some way. And I hope that the way that we set up the IRC as a retreat, we're in this kind of peculiar way, because we're not talking to each other, community is actually very important here. And that support of that in visible and invisible ways is part of what we can trust and rely on and relax in and allow something to emerge and to happen and grow and goes on. And so Andrea yesterday talked about the refuges, the things that people rely on in the world that are not really true refuges, you know, because they're not so reliable. Money and governments and status and jobs and houses and all kinds of things that can shift so quickly. But the refuges in your heart, the refuges of the Dharma, the refuge of the Four Noble Truths, the refuges of practicing the truths, the refuge of realizing them for ourselves, the refuges of community of practitioners, there's something about that, there's some way of understanding that, some way in which that operates, that they are reliable. No matter what's happening, no matter how close the mountains come, they're always there to hold us. They're always there to keep the heart fresh, to keep the heart open and free. And to have the ability to look at whatever mountains come your way. Be able to look them in the look at the mountains right in the eyes, if they had eyes. I see you. And to meet it with whatever is necessary is a powerful thing, because it means that no matter what happens in our society, whatever happens in your life, whatever social upheaval happens around you, that you have the ability to look that in the eye without being afraid, without complaining, but to meet it with confidence and courage, and to respond, to look it in the eye. One of the, it's a little bit of a maybe it sounds trite, or maybe a little silly, or maybe irritating what I'm about to say, but it's meant to be quite profound, and really pointing to the power of really understanding refuge and what it means to really go for refuge. And that's the saying that once you've gone for refuge, really gone for refuge, you have no grounds anymore to ever complain. Think about that. You were good up until this point, but you know, complaining, I can't give that up. So what is that? Why do they say that? Why in going for refuge is there no longer any grounds for complaint? I leave that as a question for you to consider, but I would like to suggest that the answer is found because you know an alternative. And you know an alternative that's so much better. And you know the cost on your heart of complaining. So what's that alternative? How are the refuges an alternative to complaining? The first person I read who wrote about this point, he wrote, I apologize for my English, not knowing how to pronounce, but is it Rail Against the World? Is that how you pronounce it? Yeah? Rail Against the World. Yes, the English is not my strong point. So Rail Against the World. No reason to rail against the world when you have gone for refuge. And it doesn't mean that we become passive. What I hope is it makes us actually courageous and confident and feel like we have something we can offer the world. I hope that those of us who begin understanding how to liberate the heart become a support and help and service for everyone else, for everyone. In our mutual world that we live in, world of mutual support and mutual care. So the refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and the refuge in ourselves, the four refuges. And I'll end that the Buddha actually gave very little instructions, so teachings about refuge itself. But one teaching he gave about refuge that gives a very different kind of context or very different perspective on what holds refuge can mean. He said, make yourself a refuge for all beings. Make yourself a refuge for all beings. So my hope is that all these are synonymous, or that if you go for refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha, if you find the inner refuge, the inner Buddha, inner Dharma, inner Sangha, that you will become a refuge for all beings. May all of us live together peacefully in mutual support. So it's custom here sometimes to take a minute or so after the talk to kind of regather into kind of the retreat mode, the contemplative mode. So if you want to just sit quietly for a minute with your eyes closed and reconnect.